Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Do 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 shaboom. 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 Oh, life could be a dream. Shaboom, if I could take you up in paradise up above. Shaboom, and tell me, darling, I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream. Sweetheart, hello, hello again. Shaboom, and hope for me again. Life could be a dream. Life could be a dream. Do, 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 shaboom.
Hi, everybody. We're doing a book giveaway next week at all of our campuses. And this is a bit personal. Part of my calling is to write, and I don't mention it much because we value community a lot and don't want anybody to use our church for self-promotion, starting with me. But writing is part of my calling, and you're my family, so I don't want it secret. And several months ago, the folks that published my book said they wanted to give a gift to say thank you to our congregation. So next weekend at all of our campuses, we're giving a free copy of this book to every household. It's called I'd Like You More If You Were More Like Me. It's about how to build intimacy with God and people. It has a dog on the cover because I love dogs. It's got a cat on the cover because I'm not in charge of the cover. Just for you all to know, it's a gift from the publisher, so it doesn't cost our church a dime. I don't make a dime off of it. It's just a way of saying thank you. And a little secret here, part of our hope is that you will use this as a chance to invite an unchurched friend and just say, we got a gift for them. And so I'm hoping next week, lots of people who are not normally at a church could find a way to our church as you invite them. That's next week. Today, the one of the big thing I want to say is South City, South San Francisco is formally launching this week. We are so excited for you. We've been looking forward to this for so long. We love you and are praying for you. Can everybody at every campus cheer on our newest congregation? And now for this message, I want to say a few words at the outset because we're talking about a subject that's real close to the heart. Maybe you're in a marriage where you're struggling and you're not sure what you want to hear about marriage and divorce. Maybe you grew up in a family and experienced divorce and you still feel that sadness. Maybe you have experienced the pain of a divorce. Maybe even been to a church where they said divorce is kind of the unforgivable sin and makes you feel like damaged goods. I hope this is a message of great clarity and hope and healing. Now here's the context. We're learning together from what Jesus taught on the Sermon on the Mount. And the passage we look at this weekend is part of a section where Jesus is redefining what makes someone a good person. He starts with anger. A good person is not just somebody who obeys you shall not kill. It's having a right heart when it comes to love and forgiveness and reconciliation. And then he goes on to sexuality. A good person is not just someone who avoids adultery. It's someone who has learned what, with God's help, to subordinate desire to what's good. And now he talks about who is a good person when it comes to divorce. But I'll warn you at the outset, these words of Jesus often look kind of weird and harsh at the outset. Here's what Jesus said. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery. And anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, this raises all kinds of questions, but I thought adultery was if I have an affair with a married person, so why would getting a divorce from my wife make her a victim of adultery? And if I marry a woman who's been divorced, which would mean that she's single now, why would that make me an adulterer? One real important thing to remember about Jesus is he was a really smart guy. He did not say things without a good reason. So we'll have to walk through this one step, one thought at a time. And the first item you'll notice here is that Jesus is just addressing men. When he gives the Sermon on the Mount generally, he's addressing a whole crowd of men and women. But we saw last week around sexuality, and this week with marriage and divorce, he's just talking to men. Now, why is that? Is that because women are relationally superior to men, and it's men that need remedial attention? No. In that day, it appears to be the case that pretty much only men had the power to get a divorce. That's why he talks to men. In the ancient world generally, if you were a woman, your husband could divorce you anytime for any reason just by walking out of the house. And you, the woman, would be stuck with the kids and with no money. In the unlikely event that you ever got money, maybe your sons would grow up and make the farm profitable, or you go to Nineveh and win a blackjack or something, your original husband could return at any time and reclaim you and the kids and the money. And no man is going to marry you if husband number one, who left you, is lurking around out there. If you were a woman and your marriage died, then you were in deep trouble. So the law of Moses that we read about in the Old Testament, when you compare it to the ancient Near East, was striking in its concern for women. Moses put it like this: when a man takes a wife and marries her, if she then finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house. That's from the book of Deuteronomy. This certificate was actually a way of protecting the woman in the ancient world. It meant that her first husband could not come back and claim her. On the certificate of divorce, and lots of them have been found by archaeologists, it would actually say, you are free to remarry any Jewish man you wish. So when Jesus comes along in the Sermon on the Mount, here's what he's basically saying. You know, gang, you've all been dividing up the sheep and the goats like this. The bad guys are the guys who divorce their wives by just walking out and don't give them a certificate of divorce to protect them. You've been thinking, marriage exists for my fulfillment. I'm free to divorce anytime I feel like it. All my options are open. As long as I give her a certificate of divorce, then I am righteous in God's eyes. I'm in compliance. And then, in this section of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus has not been giving laws about anger or adultery or oaths. He describes the way a person who has surpassing righteousness, true God-given inner goodness, would think and feel and act. Now, even in our day, divorce is usually disproportionately hard on women. In that culture, it was way worse. Unless the woman had a rich relative who would take her in as a quasi-servant, and that was unlikely, she basically had two choices. She could marry another man who would receive her as damaged goods, often as one of multiple wives, or she could become a prostitute. Either way, she would be living in a sexually degraded, pain of adultery condition. Now, Jesus is saying, a kingdom kind of man, husband, will recognize that, and that kind of man will be more concerned about the well-being of his wife than he will with himself. A man who's living in the kingdom of God will reject that keep your options open and look for a spouse upgrade culture, and seek for his wife's welfare above his own. He will the good for his wife. Jesus, again here, is not giving laws. He's describing true surpassing goodness. But I know, for many people, the question of, is divorce ever permissible? And if so, when, from a biblical standpoint, is a huge one. So I want to look at what rabbis in Jesus' day taught about divorce and then see what else Jesus says. Now, we've already seen that Deuteronomy mentions divorce on the grounds of indecency. In the Hebrew language, that was on the grounds of a cause of sexual immorality. So that was one ground for divorce where there would be permission to remarry. But then we'd wonder, what about other cases? What about when there was, like, abuse or abandonment? Well, those cases were covered in the Old Testament as well, in a kind of a roundabout way from a passage in the book of Exodus. In Exodus chapter 21, the law covers what happens if a man takes a second wife, which would happen in the ancient world. And this passage is designed to protect the rights of the first wife. It says, If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her, the first wife's food, her clothing, or her conjugal love. If he does not provide her with these three things, she is free to go without payment of money. Now, once again, the law was seeking to protect women in the ancient world. In the ancient world, when a husband took on a new wife, wife number two tended to get the good stuff. And the law said he made a vow when he married his first wife to provide support, food and clothing and love. And if he breaks that vow, she's free to leave, to get a divorce, and that would mean getting a certificate and being able to remarry. So over time, rabbis looked at these two passages, the one in Deuteronomy and the one in Exodus, and said, here's the overarching principle involved. Marriage is a vow that covers three areas. Fidelity, that means no sexual unfaithfulness, and provision, and love, that means sexual intimacy and affection. Where these vows are broken, the victim of the broken vows has the right to get divorced and remarried. Now, rabbis would debate what constituted breaking these vows, how much food had to be, what kind of clothing. And they would make rules about conjugal love. Rabbis said that husbands had to offer to be intimate with their wife twice a week or she could divorce them. This is from the ancient rabbinic world. Or rabbis sometimes would teach once a week if he was a donkey driver. It's kind of like a trucker that's on the road a lot. Or if the husband was unemployed, he had to offer every night or she could divorce him. I'm not making this up. Now, did rabbis believe there could be biblical grounds for divorce around abandonment or abuse? Of course they did. Abandonment was an extreme form of breaking the vow to provide. Abuse was an extreme form of breaking the vow to love. Okay, so that was the rabbinic framework for understanding marriage and divorce and remarriage. In Jesus' day, there was a completely new development. Two of the most famous rabbis a few decades about Jesus were named Hillel and Shammai. And Rabbi Hillel had a new interpretation of Deuteronomy 24:1. He claimed that it said a man could divorce his wife for a cause of indecency. And when it said that, it meant any cause at all. Rabbis in Hillel school decided that this any cause divorce was available only to men. And any cause covered any fault that you could conceive of. And they wrote down different potential ones. Rabbis said things like, if she spoiled his dinner, if she walked around with her hair unbound, if she argued in a voice loud enough to be heard next door. So this is a new kind of divorce in Jesus' day, any cause divorce. One drawback to any cause divorce was it was more expensive. If you could prove that your wife was guilty of breaking a vow, like adultery, then you did not have to pay back what was called the ketubah, the marriage inheritance promised at a wedding. But if I did the any cause divorce, just divorce her because I didn't like her cooking or something, then the husband had to pay this price back. So Hillel is saying there's now a new divorce option that's available to Israel, any cause divorce. And very soon, that kind of divorce for any cause at all was the most popular. And many of you know of a case in the Bible where it was actually considered. When Joseph found out that his fiancée, Mary, was pregnant, we're told, because Joseph did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. Now, in that day, even when you were engaged, to break off the relationship required a divorce. When the text says he thought about doing it quietly, that's not a vague adjective. It's actually a technical term. It meant that he would not call her an adulterer in court, that he would get an any-cause divorce. And that meant that he would pay the price. He would support the child. Okay? So that's the any-cause divorce. It's based on this interpretation from Rabbi Hillel that says Deuteronomy was saying you could divorce your wife for any cause. However, Rabbi Shammai and his followers disagreed. They said, no, no, that passage in Deuteronomy refers only to sexual immorality. So that only breaking that vow or the vows of provision and love from Exodus 21 were legal grounds for divorce. They said that any cause divorce was wrong. Now, in Jesus' day, this is a big debate. We're told one time some Pharisees came to Jesus to test him or trap him. They asked him, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause?" Now, when they did this, they were not asking Jesus, "Rabbi, is divorce always against the law?" That was not debated. Divorce is in Moses' law. It was done in the case of vow breaking. No rabbi would ask, "Is it lawful for us to follow Moses' law?" What they're asking Jesus here is, how do you interpret Deuteronomy 24, verse 1? Are you a Hillel guy or a Shammai guy? Now, Pharisees already know that Jesus rejects the any clause school. You can just divorce your wife for any reason at all. He's already talked about that. They know he's a Shammai guy on this one. Here's why it's a trap. Some of you might know that the ruler of Galilee back then was a man by the name of Herod. Herod had been married to his first wife. He had fallen in love with a woman named Herodias. Herodias was already married, by the way, to Herod's brother. So Herod divorced wife number one. He got an any-cause divorce. And he had Herodias divorce her husband, his brother, and then he married her, his sister-in-law. And John the Baptist talked about this. We're told in the Gospel of Matthew, John the Baptist courageously said to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have her." That any-cause divorce wasn't valid. Anybody remember what happened to John the Baptist? Herod cut off his head. Now, Herod is looking for Jesus. So when Jesus says, John was right, any-cause divorces are wrong, guess who is the first person that those religious leaders will make sure hears about this? Of course, that's Herod. So Jesus responds, "Haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, 'For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." Jesus is taking marriage back to Genesis, and this is loaded. If you look at what God does in Genesis, he separates and then he joins together. He separates light from darkness and puts them together to make a day. He separates sky from the earth, puts them to make our environment. He separates dry land from the seas, puts them together to make our planet. Creation is God separating and then joining to defeat chaos and make shalom. And then he creates man. And he makes a woman. Anybody remember what he makes her from? From the rib. And people wonder, that seems a little unscientific. Well, there's an Old Testament scholar named John Walton. He writes brilliantly about this. That word rib is much better translated side. And you'll see that in footnotes in newer translations. In other words, the writer is not describing the process of the physical construction of the woman's skeleton. It's not like God is using Legos or something. The writer is naming God's intent about the nature of man and woman and marriage. They are created with equal worth to stand side by side, to have a capacity of separateness, but then also oneness side by side. God separates day from night. God separates sky from land. God separates sea from land. And now male and female are made to be separate so that they can be joined together and the two shall become one flesh. This is new creation, new shalom, oneness now of heart and will and servanthood, like Father, Son, and Spirit are one. It's a beautiful passage. But then what this means, Jesus is saying, is divorce is undoing creation. It is unraveling shalom. That is why Jesus says, what God has joined together, let no one separate. That's why the Bible is so serious, so severe about divorce. And if you're feeling a little heavy right now, if this feels a little weighty on you, if you've been through this pain, I want you to imagine how the disciples felt when they heard Jesus teaching this stuff. When he got done, their response was this. The disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it is better not to marry." In other words, like, if I'm just going to be stuck with her, who in their right mind would do that? Now, the Pharisees are sure Jesus can't be right, so they have another question. Why then, they ask, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? They're referring out of that Deuteronomy 24 passage. Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. Now, Jesus is getting here to the real issue when it comes to grounds for divorce. And as we have seen over and over in the Sermon on the Mount, it comes not to behavioral compliance, but to the heart. The problem that necessitates the tragedy of divorce is the ultimate problem of the human condition, hard-heartedness. Hard-heartedness. Jesus didn't say Moses commanded you to get divorced. He says he permitted it because of hard-heartedness. In our day, the most common reason given for divorce is incompatibility. But Jesus does not say because of incompatibility, Moses said, give the woman a certificate of divorce. G.K. Chesterton, a great Christian thinker and writer, wrote, I have known many happy marriages, but never a compatible one. The whole aim of marriage is to fight through and survive the instant when incompatibility becomes unquestionable. For a man and a woman as such are incompatible. There may be a breaking of core marriage vows. Even that is not mechanical or legalistic grounds for divorce. If your spouse breaks a vow but then is repentant, soft-hearted, then rebuild the marriage. If your spouse refuses to repent, if there is a stubborn, defiant, continued decision to reject reconciliation, to refuse counsel, if there's continued rejection of physical intimacy, a willful continuation of patterns of deceit, abandonment, stealing, cruelty, then divorce may be the only option. Now I want to give you a few pastoral words here. If you're married, grow your marriage. Don't take it for granted. Know details about your spouse's day. Serve your spouse. Cheer your spouse on. Work at your marriage. One of the biggest predictors of divorce is when communication constantly has barbs in it. Could you help your fatherless son with his homework? Nancy and I were with a ministry called Great Dates a few weeks ago. And to see scores of couples building their marriages was just thrilling. And we talked real openly about our own marriage. I got to tell you, our marriage is very, very imperfect. But being married to Nancy is the greatest human gift I have. She is my number one fan. She is my number one critic. And if you think those two don't go together, you do not know what it is to be loved by somebody who cherishes for you to become your best self. And when she is in fan mode, cheering me on, encouraging me, affirming me, praising me, believing in me, I really love it. And when she's in critic mode, challenging me, confronting me, getting in my face and on my back, I really love it, mostly. If you're married, your assignment is to ask your spouse today, how are we doing? Really? And then listen. Without getting defensive. I know people who take their business and their career and their finances and their health really seriously, and they never think about their marriage. Every marriage can grow because every person can grow. If your marriage is hard, and Nancy and I have known those seasons, seek wise counsel, pray, read, ask friends for prayer, get help, get support. It is worth heroic effort, because marriage is what God has joined together. I asked Nancy a while ago, what was the best day of her life ever? And I knew the answer ahead of time. I knew she would say it was the day she married me. That was not her answer. When she was a little girl, there was a lot of fighting in her home growing up. Sometimes she would hide the car keys so that her mom or dad couldn't go driving off in anger. And then the day came when she was a little girl when her daddy moved out. And she had to shuttle back and forth, and creation unraveled for her. And then after a year of this, they surprised her by taking her out for dinner and asking her, how would you like it if Daddy moved back in and Mommy and Daddy and you, we all lived together like a family again? That was her best day. And after that were the births of our three children. And after that was the day we left Chicago and came back to California. But I'm not long after that. Some of you are working on marriages that are hard right now, and this is a place where everybody is cheering you on. By the way, guess how many perfect marriages we have at our church? Every marriage is a marriage between two great big sinners held together by the grace of God. See, there are some churches where there's this kind of separation. Married people are good, divorced people are bad. That's precisely the kind of superficial approach to who's good and who's not that Jesus is going against in the Sermon on the Mount. I say that because maybe you've been through divorce and you wonder what God has left for you. Will you be stuck with plan B? You ought to know about a young ministerial candidate whose wife left him, whose marriage ended, and he thought, God's never going to use me. And then he discovered grace and got back in the game. And his name was Walt Gerber. And for 27 years, he was the senior pastor of this church. He had one of the great pastoral runs anybody has seen right here. I was thinking, who do you think is the most spiritually significant divorced person in the Bible? And at first I thought maybe the Samaritan woman at the well. You might know her story. She'd been through five husbands, was now living with a guy that she wasn't even married to. Jesus honors her with the longest conversation he ever had in the Bible. She became the first preacher about Jesus, saved her whole town. But she's only number two. I'll tell you about this most significant spiritual divorced person. The main picture God used to describe his relationship with his people was that it was a covenant like a marriage. Israel was like his bride. And then God makes this statement through the prophet Jeremiah, I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of all her adulteries. That's God. God knows the humiliation of rejection and the pain of betrayal from hard-hearted people like me. God says in the Bible through the prophet, he's been through a divorce. He is a divorcee. So God invented the first divorce recovery program. It's at a place called Calvary. And the price for the course is one blood-stained cross. And Jesus paid it. He was the first one to go through the program. It's still in session. We have a divorce recovery ministry here that might be God's gift to you right now, or maybe for somebody that you love. But the deep reality is we are all implicit in this divorce that God is talking about. We have all been unfaithful to God. And that's why any church that divides people into non-divorced first-class Christians and divorced second-class Christians is theologically errant and spiritually destructive. On the most important spiritual level, we have all been unfaithful. We all need the cross. So go there and then get into community. Married, single. A recent study of 10,000 seniors from Yale University showed that loners were twice as likely to die from all causes over a five-year period than people with close friendships. Twice as likely to die. That's why the motto of our life group ministry is join a life group or die. There is a reason they're called life group, not death groups. Because this is a place where everybody's welcome. This is a place where nobody's perfect. This is a place where we're not broken up into married people, never married people, divorced people, just all sinners whose lives are a train wreck apart from God, but who are learning to live as apprentices to Jesus in the reality of his kingdom of grace. That's why this is a place where anything is possible. Healing is possible. Strong marriages are possible. Forgiveness is possible. Grace is whatever is possible. So whatever you do, don't miss grace.